Good afternoon. So as you know, the government received the Waitangi Tribunal's report on Friday, and we thank them for providing that to us. We will be carefully considering its recommendations in good faith over the coming days. It is approximately a 275-page document, and lawyers and officials are working their way through it. The Crown lawyers will be presenting their advice to me on this, but I haven't had an extensive discussion on the matter with them, with either them or with my Cabinet colleagues at this point. Over the coming days, I'll be taking advice on the report, and I hope to make an announcement early next week on the future steps we intend to take. Till then, I'm not really in a position to comment much further on the report or the government's position. Just in terms of activity, this week in the House we have the third reading of the Exclusive Economic Zone and Continental Shelf Bill, and the first reading of the National War Memorial Park Empowering Bill. Wednesday is, of course, a Members' Day. On Thursday morning, the Business Committee has approved extended hours, and we'll have a debate on Social Service Services Select Committee report on the identification, rehabilitation and care and protection of child offenders. We also have three second readings: the Legislation Bill, the Identity Information Confirmation Bill and the Electronic Identity Verification Bill. And in the afternoon we expect to see start part two of the committee stage of the Alcohol Law Reform Bill. In terms of my activities this week, I'll be in Wellington tomorrow for caucus and question time. Early on Wednesday morning with some of you, I leave for the 43rd Annual Pacific Islands Forum in the Cook Islands. The leaders' meeting is an opportunity for the region to come together and work on issues facing our countries. The theme this year will be oceans and fisheries, and discussions will focus on how the Pacific's significant marine resources can be protected, while also ensuring they contribute to the substantial and sustainable development of the region. New Zealand hosted the 2011 forum in Auckland, and this year I'll be formally handing over the chairing of the forum to the Cook Islands Prime Minister, Henry Puna. We will fly on the Air Force to the Cook Islands, departing on Wednesday and returning on Saturday evening. Lastly, can I just say congratulations to Lydia Ko for taking up the LPGA, the Canadian Golf Open today, and good luck to our team, 26 Paralympians, who will start competing at the 2012 London Paralympics later in the week.
Are you still confident, given that report and the initial advice you may have received, that you will be able to go ahead and float Mighty River this year?
Well, the government's preferred option is to be able to take Mighty River Power to the market this year. That fits in with our desires to release money into the Future Investment Fund and then to be able to reinvest that on behalf of the New Zealanders. So, look, we'll be taking advice from our lawyers and officials this week. We're in a position, we think, early next week to make a decision about what our next steps are.
Are you less confident now, given the report that we received?
No, I wouldn't really want to characterise that. I mean, the timeframe's always been tight, which is why we asked the Waitangi Tribunal if they could give us their findings last week. We're thankful that they were able to do that. But if we're going to make a IPO timetable of 2012, then we'll need to move that process along. So we'll be in a position to give you some sense of where we're going. We think early next week.
Is the shares plus a possibility that Charles talked about, shares plus, which is not only shares but extras as well, in terms of the constitution of companies and so forth? Are you of the mind to go that far?
There's a lot of individual recommendations in the report. And, you know, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to go in there and delve into the individual aspects of those today. I have asked the lawyers and officials to give me extensive advice on the whole report, on every aspect. That's one of the aspects I'll obviously be covering and giving the government advice. But I've neither received that advice nor had any extensive conversations with them about it.
Is there anything in the report that surprised you?
Probably not overly. I mean, in fairness, they'd given us their interim report. They did flesh out their thinking a little further, so it's probably in line with what their initial findings were.
Are you court ready for any legal challenge that were to arise in the next couple of weeks?
Well, there's been an indication, hasn't there, from the Māori Council that they're likely to want to take legal action in the event that the government decides to press ahead. That's people's free right if that's the way it ultimately goes, but you can obviously see within Māori there's quite a range of views. And the Paramount Chief, Tumi Tuhuhu, coming out over the weekend saying he didn't think that just litigious route through the courts was the right way to go. So there's a range of different views in there, but the Crown's had long held views and well established positions, and if that was an option, then of course we'd be ready to go to court.
Have we
in the week before the election, we ruled out any deal under which Māori would get preferential shares. Is that still the position?
Well, as I say, I don't want to go into individual parts of that today. I'm asking people to give us a week because we have both a legal and moral responsibility to go through that report. We're going to do that, but I'm pretty confident I'll be in a position on Monday, having analysed all of that, to tell you what the government's response is. I don't think there should be anything in or out of my comments today.
Has anything changed, though, since November 19,
Well, we presented a strong view in line with what the Crown's thinking is. Obviously, the Waitangi Tribunal's come up with a series of its own recommendations. We're required to now go and review those recommendations. We'll do that in good faith.
Does that mean you will consider preferential shares?
No, what it said is we'll review the recommendations of the Waitangi Tribunal in good faith.
Are you worried that given the uncertainty from the water rights, the Tiwai point, all the other factors, that investors now are going to want to pay less money for this company?
Well, again, I'm really not in a position where I can offer an opinion on that because of securities legislation. What I can say is at the point at which the government takes a product, you know, like a float on the SOE to the market, it'll do so with full disclosure of any issues or risks and leave it to others to assess what the appropriate value is.
The variable views among Maori on this issue that you've referred to a number of times, does that make a pan-tribal agreement less attractive?
I think what it shows is that there's a range of views. I mean, the government has for a long period of time held the view that no one owns water, and it's long held the view that there are genuine rights and interests, and our government and successive governments have over the course of time been negotiating those rights and interests. And I think what you can see from some EU leaders is they're finding that a quite satisfactory process and one that's likely to deliver better results than going through the courts. And they're probably reflecting on the situation we've seen in countries like Canada, where these things have been tied up for a very, very long period of time through the court process. So generally, negotiation is the government's preferred position, and that's something we look forward to continuing if we can.
So what is enough time to negotiate, Prime Minister? You set it in off the next, cabinet.
Yeah.
I know, before you're going to make it. Does a week give you enough time to get this thing going again or not?
There's two fundamental issues here, isn't there? One is what are the rights and interests of Maori in water, and my government and previous governments have established some of those rights and interests along the way so far. Of course, all of those can't be registered or acknowledged between here and next Monday. But the fundamental question, of course, is would the sale of shares in a state-owned enterprise in any way limit Maori's capacity to recognise or establish their rights and interests? The Crown's view is it wouldn't, and that's been the whole fundamental basis of the argument.
So why don't you just say now to go into them?
Because, I haven't sat down with our lawyers or officials in any great depth. I've had some very preliminary discussions with them. They're in the process of feverishly writing me reports and a review of the Waitangi Tribunal recommendations. When I've had an opportunity to do that, we'll probably have an opportunity to have a further discussion, obviously, with the Māori Party. I've got to take my own cabinet colleagues through it, and I'm pretty confident by next Monday I'll be in a position to give you a much more authoritative view on what our thinking is and why.
Are you specifically asking though for your official voices to give you advice on whether you can proceed with the sale or not?
Well, that's the government's preferred position, is to go to take Māori power to the market. And the reason for wanting to get to a timetable of next week, in part, is because if we give ourselves any chance of achieving that in 2012, recognising that there could or was likely to be some legal action taken against the government if we did proceed, is to give ourselves, you know, that time frame. We also think that's given we've had some, you know, early warning about the sorts of issues, probably enough time for us to be able to digest the thinking and recommendations from the tribunal in good faith to consider those. But I literally have not had that discussion with the relevant parties yet, and I wouldn't want to prejudge what they're saying.
In terms of their advice, presumably you would want them to tell you whether you can proceed or whether there are enough fishhooks in that report to cause problems in the government.
Well, I want them to give me free and frank advice about the merits of the arguments as presented by the Waitangi Tribunal, and then ultimately what that might mean in terms of the government's mixed ownership model program.
Great. Thank you.
The government has gone on the front foot and seek a High Court ruling on it itself about Maori ownership.
That would be a very, very long process.
Is one of the options that...
No problems. I sometimes forget my answer. This gets me in slightly more problems.
Can you say what's on the table in those parallel negotiations that have been going on? I presume that's with the iwi leaders group.
Well, it's a matter of public record what we've negotiated so far. I mean, in terms of rights and interests, they largely are around the sort of governance arrangements and the Kaitiakitanga principles, you know, really around the guardianship of the river. So if you go back to the Waikato River authority and the establishment of that, that's really been the basis of the kinds of rights and interests. There's been some specific springs that we've been negotiating with iwi about, but they're really more around the health of the waterway and its future development.
So there's nothing in terms of sort of control or some sort of representation on
No, there has been. I mean, the Waikato River has had that. I mean, there's a co-management agreement of the Waikato River now.
On the mixed ownership
model? On the boards of the companies?
Yeah.
No.
Do you think you could manage your time frame and announce a sort of a framework or mechanism by which iwi could register their interests without needing to actually have a settlement? Or that be carried out before the end of the year?
Look, in truth, I need to get advice from our legal team about what they believe is the merits of the arguments as presented by the Waitangi Tribunal. The government's had up until this point, a process that I think, in all fairness, has worked well, and that is, river by river, waterway by waterway, iwi by iwi, we've been negotiating and debating rights and interests, and that's been a successful program in the course of the last 4 years. In recent years, iwi have also been involved in the Land and Water Forum. Again, that's been successful. And I think the reason that you're seeing iwi leaders, in some cases, openly express a desire to see that process continue rather than a court process is their confidence that their rights and interests will be recognised.
Would you say you're less confident now about getting Wairi River to market this year?
No, I wouldn't say that.
Doesn't that process you're talking about create uncertainty, though, over what purchasers will be getting? They're not clear what rights and interest, how those rights and interests will be expressed down the line.
No, I'm not sure that's right. I mean, they'll be able to look towards what we have historically agreed, and we'll be giving next week, one assumes. I mean, again, it's have those discussions yet, but I'll be hoping to come to this press conference next Monday and spell out where the government's going, which parts of the reports it accepts, which parts it might reject, and the rationale for that. And I think those who might be interested in investing in those companies will be able to get a bit of a sense of what that means as best they can. But at the heart of all of this is ultimately a treaty settlement process, and New Zealand investors are quite savvy in terms of the fact that as a country we have that process and how it roughly works.
Does the prior commitment of not legislating on this issue still stand now that you have that Waitangi Tribunal report in front of you?
Yes, but we need to work our way through the merits of the report and what the government's response to those recommendations are. There'll always be different interpretations about rights and interests.
So depending on what legal advice you get from your officials, the position about legislating to solve the issue could change?
No, what I'm saying to you is that we will be acknowledging what we believe to be genuine rights and interests.
I don't know whether Alex asked this, I couldn't hear the question, but is one of your options the government initiating a declaratory judgment?
Look, I've never received any advice on that matter, except the sort of general consensus view from lawyers that I've talked to about that fact is that would be a very difficult process for the courts to actually establish that. If you're asking the basic question, can the courts establish who owns water? We believe under common law that's been established, that no one owns water. But going further than that, I mean, it's very difficult to see how the courts would actually be able to assess that on its merits.
Okay, thank you.
Has the uncertainty around some of the other possible flights, I'm thinking of the TY point issue around Meridian, has that opened up a gap in March that you could postpone for a minor of power too?
Well, I think it stands to reason that, as a thing I've said in the past, because we really need to go to market with fresh, audited and up-to-date accounts, we only have a couple of opportunities in each calendar year to bring an IPO to the market. And that's the sort of most conservative legal position, and then I think the one the Crown would want to adopt. So by definition, if we can't hit a timetable of late 2012, the next window is, by definition, March, April 2013.
We'll put it the other way around. Will Meridian or Genesis be ready by March 2012?
Well, all the advice I've seen so far is that the three major power companies are in a position where they would be able to go to the market. It's much less clear, obviously, about solid energy and New Zealand subject to price reading in the market.
But would you want to do two IPOs in any one calendar year?
That's possible.
Any 1 month, though?
Not only 1 month. I would have thought the advice we would get would be digestion risk and stuff, but within any 12-month period.
You could do 1 March, April, and November, October.
That's possible, I would have thought.
In terms of the money being spent out of this future investment fund, the proceeds, was the plan to start spending it from day one of getting it in, or...
Once you've got the process started to tick over, I'm sure you can probably pre-spend against that a little bit, but in the end, it forms the basis of our capital program. I mean, if you go and have a look in the Crown budget accounts, we have a zero capital budget, and that's because we're relying solely on the proceeds we get from the mixed ownership model to fund our capital program.
But you're being asked for such a project, may not wait 2 or 3 months.
Of course they can, yeah.
So the delay might not matter?
Well, yes, but I mean, like anything, I mean, we have to work to a timetable, but the government's preferred timetable, as indicated up to this point, has been to start in 2012.
The argument is that a delay might add to debt, but the debt
burden is... Well, adds potentially to cost, because if we want to pre-start some of those programs, we have to borrow the money. That was the argument the Crown always put up before the tribunal.
Right, but it's just delay those programs a couple of months.
There's some cost in that.
Just looking at the Yongming Yan Bill Lucas, what are your thoughts on the fact that this guy with multiple identities is essentially walking around New Zealand as a citizen like you or I, and nothing has been done about it?
Well, I didn't see the 60 Minutes program, but I'm obviously aware of the debate that's going on. What I'd say is, especially there's an Auditor General's report, and until we really get that report, it's very difficult to pass any further comment. I mean, that would be seen as coming across that report. I mean, if you're asking the basic question about whether this person could have their citizenship taken off them, there are grounds and tests a minister has to meet, and whether those tests have been breached. We can't pass judgment on until we see the Auditor General's report.
So there is a possibility, though, that the government could go in and revoke or deprive this man of citizenship after that report?
Well, there's a legal basis you have to meet, which is the minister has to, can deprive a person of citizenship if they're satisfied that they obtained the citizenship by fraud, false representation, or willful concealment of relevant information or by mistake. So the test is that the minister would have to believe that that was the basis under which the citizenship was granted. And I'm not in a position to pass judgment on that.
But it does give the minister the discretion, essentially, doesn't it? The fact that he was found not guilty by the court, it still was up to the minister at some point.
It's possible, but of course the minister would have to satisfy himself that those tests are there. In other words, that information was willfully concealed, for instance.
Yeah. And what do you think of the fact, that he's got a New Zealand passport? It's obviously a privilege to have one of these passports. Does this damage the integrity of our passport system, the fact that this guy's waltzing around?
I don't think overall. I think if I understand the basis of the 60 Minutes piece last night, they are asking us a substantial number of questions and that's probably the reason why this matter is now before the Auditor General. And clearly Shane Jones has got some big questions to answer, but he'll need to answer those questions to the Auditor General. Overall, that most New Zealanders would have a high degree of confidence in the process for granting citizenship.
Yeah, you don't think this takes away some of that confidence? You know, if I was walking around downtown Auckland with a passport under it?
Well, hopefully not. I mean, A, he's been through a court process at this point, and has we passed that process. Secondly, we deal with a lot of people who become citizens, just like in every major function that we have, from health to education to the justice system. And I think most New Zealanders don't judge it by the one or two exceptions, if this is the case here. It's too early for me to pass shaping on it.
Those comments by someone person about...
Look, I really think they're unfortunate. This is a fine New Zealand soldier that's passed away, and I think people should just be careful in making those kinds of comments.
But the reaction that Perry Fabian received, he threw some sorts of other
certainly inappropriate threats. Well, obviously we don't condone that, but it's a highly charged debate, isn't it? I mean, I think it's important for everyone to be thoughtful in these cases.
Have you been briefed on these reports of the Taliban issuing direct threats against New Zealand troops and
Taliban? Yeah, I mean, look, I've seen the reports, but the vice I've had is that there's no authenticity of them. We can't confirm that they are genuine. There's a degree of propaganda from what we can see about them. So, yes, people make some comments, but the basis and merits of them, I don't have any advice on those. I mean, we are in a war zone in Afghanistan. We're in an environment in the northeast part of Bamiyan, which is clearly a dangerous environment. And I think you can rest assured that the military and via the Chief of Defence Forces are doing everything they possibly can within the context of that environment to try and make sure our people are as safe as possible.
But given the 5 deaths in just a short space of time,
I don't think you can draw exactly that conclusion. In the case of Harley Durrow and Rory Malone, I mean, they were really responding to an NDS call out, and there's some thought there that they actually surprised the insurgents, so I'm not entirely sure you could say they were targeted. In the case of our other three soldiers who died last Sunday, yeah, I think they were deliberately targeted given where the bomb was placed.
Has there been any further progress then on what's going to be done to try and reduce the threat in terms of, I guess, finding the bomb maker?
Yes. I mean, the military are obviously very focused, as they always are, on the safety and security of our people, on doing everything they can, taking all the steps necessary to try and minimise that, the risks to our people. And they're, I think, working quite aggressively on that, as they have been for some time. Some of those things we're just not in a position to talk about what the next steps might be.
We still haven't got approval yet to patrol more widely into the area.
You'd need to take that up directly with the CDF, but my understanding is that sometimes that's done on a case-by-case basis, and sometimes they can get a blanket approval for that, but you need to ask them directly.
Your cabinet approval to do that still stands? You haven't withdrawn that?
No, we haven't withdrawn that.
Could you give the advice on the nature of that IED? Was there anything particularly sophisticated about it?
I don't think I've learned anything from last week. I mean, just I've seen the satellite pictures of the explosion. It's clearly an extremely large bomb.
With regard to the Pacific Forum, have you got a bilateral scheduled yet with Hillary Clinton?
I can't confirm that she's actually coming to Rarotonga. I know that it's potentially planned, but her visit isn't confirmed. If she does come, then yes, we would like to sit down with her, and we're likely to, but there's no guarantee she'll be there yet.
If that meeting does occur, what will be the focus of conversation for you?
Well, we thought pretty wide-ranging. I mean, obviously Afghanistan's an area that we tend to have discussions, and just generally the economy. She is in such a privileged position to understand and be intimately involved with many of the hotspots around the world. It's always good to talk to her about what's happening in places like Syria, for instance. Obviously there'll be a bit of a general political update on what she thinks happening in the US election, so I imagine it'll be quite wide-ranging.
Did you say you'd actually see a satellite picture of the explosion, or it's aftermath?
It's aftermath.
Do you have any sort of advice on any potential regulation around the selling of this butane gas, which these kids are doing this.
Oh, look, I haven't seen any advice on that yet. My understanding is that the coroner is going to produce a report about these potential deaths in about a month or two. So I haven't seen the report yet, but obviously we're focused on the issue of substance abuse, and you know, health and other ministries will always look at those issues. But he hasn't actually produced a report yet for us to examine.
And if there are recommendations, and obviously you could look at further regulation around the violence.
Well, my understanding is he's saying that there could be quite a substantial number of deaths linked to this, up to 50 people in a reasonably short period of time. So. You know, of course, we can take that seriously, but we just need to look at what he's saying.
How are you voting on the drinking age and why?
I'm voting for split age, and the reason is that I think that within a licensed bar environment, you've got a degree of reasonable degree of supervision. So you generally have bouncers, you have bar staff who are heavily focused on making sure that the law is observed. In the case of off-licences, I'm going to vote for the age to go up to 20, and the reason for that is that I think that that's a source used to supply young people with binge drinking, and so it's. I'm not sure we can absolutely prove it in fact, but it's more likely 18-year-olds hang around with 15 and 16-year-olds than 20-year-olds do. And so I think there's a chance, if we lift the age of purchase and off-licence, we'll see less alcohol being obtained by younger people. In the event that that fails and gets kicked out, probably just leave the age at 18. But there's many permutations and combinations in Senate to fill out my proxy voting form. It took me back to multi-choice of school suit, so there are many boxes to check.
Are you voting for gay marriage?
I am, yeah.
But do you have any sense that the split age has the support that it always has had in the past, or is there some suggestion that it might be softening a little bit?
I think it'll get through, but I might be wrong. We haven't had a big debate for some time in our caucus now, but it strikes me that if you take a step back and think about what's happening, we've spent 20 years of liberalisation of alcohol rules and regulations in New Zealand. You're now seeing Parliament going on a different tact, and that is responding to a strong perception from everyday New Zealanders that they'd like to see change. So we are making changes, and I think most MPs will take that as a message to make some change, and purchase age is one of those. I'll be surprised if they go to all up to 20, but I'd be fairly surprised if they all stay at 18.
Some people have some concerns about the practicalities of a split age view.
Yeah, well, there are some arguments around that. I mean, it's not perfect. So there is an argument that says at 19 you'd be old enough to go off to the local bar and have a beer, but if you decide to pick up a six-pack on the way home to have it at the barbecue, you wouldn't be legally allowed to do that. And I can understand the merits of why that seems a slightly odd position to be in. But it's really about trying to say, look, we're just making a number of potential moves overall to try and reduce heavy binge drinking by very young people.
Just on the Waitangi Tribunal report, they said that the claim was not opportunistic, which was obviously a direct counter to what you had said. Is that their job to sort of,
critique
respond me. To you?
Yeah. Look, it's not going to be helpful if I engage in discussion on that.
Wouldn't it be
not helpful to me anyway.
In the long run, wouldn't it be, wouldn't you save yourself a lot of aggravation and grief if you just announced a delay until next year, until that April, May flow time, to give yourself the time to come to an accommodation roughly along the lines of the tribunal is suggesting, and then you can go to the market without the threat of legal action and with some certainty for buyers?
I don't think that logic actually is necessarily right. I mean, we need to test that with our lawyers, but I'm not sure that's right.
On Afghanistan, are you able to provide any more confirmation on the April withdrawal date?
We haven't made that decision at Cabinet yet, but it's highly likely it'll be April.
And just on, sorry, jumping around, but marriage equality as well. Some MPs are getting quite a number of emails coming in
from
people. Have you seen many, and have you got any views on the nature of those submissions?
I haven't had a good look at it. I mean, my systems at work are reasonably sophisticated for obvious reasons, where they try and filter things in and out. But there will be a deluge of email campaigns of both ways on this issue. And that's the only comment I've made to my caucus, which is, if you haven't been through this process before, these things get very emotionally charged, and there will be a lot of email correspondence if prostitution law reform and civil union and anything else, all those other issues are anything to go by.
Has it been as heated on alcohol?
Well, there's certainly been campaigns on alcohol. Again, there's a range of views there. So it's not as probably as intense in terms of the numbers as I would anticipate some of these other issues.
You mentioned a couple of weeks ago you polled in your own electorate on marriage equality. Have you done that?
I haven't done it yet, no. Long way to go yet. Okay, thanks very much.